Well, this morning we're in installment number 10 in our summer series on the life of Abraham. Abraham, who serves in many ways as the prototype of every person who walks in faith with God. The story of Abraham is the story of how God creates a person to be his friend and then develops that person so the friendship is both reciprocal and authentic. Because each of us is also being developed to be a friend of God. When we read the story of Abraham, we should be looking for parallels to our own stories. Many of the things that God did in the life of Abraham, he will do in some form or another in our own lives. Now, the Bible was never intended to be a historical book. It contains history, but that's not its main purpose. Nor is it a devotional guide, even though much of its content is rich in devotional application. The Bible was really intended to be an owner's manual. I just bought a new watch the other day. My old one was starting to let me down. You know, Murphy's Law, I was late for the first staff meeting that I wore the watch to. But I knew I was late. And that's the important thing. But when I bought this watch, it came with an owner's manual. This is a complicated watch. I can time Dave's sermons to 1/1000th of a second. That's an important feature. I have no idea why someone would want a chronograph that can time things to 1/1000th of a second, but by golly, if there's ever a need for it, I'm your man. Come see me. This watch will do things. I can fumble my way through, but with the owner's manual, I know how every dial and button and knob is supposed to work. I haven't got it to work yet, but that's what the Bible does, really. It's the owner's manual for life. Human beings come with an owner's manual. We don't really think about that much. It tells us how life works best. We can wing it if we want, but when we really want to understand how life works, we turn to the owner's manual. Once you know what the Bible is really intended to do, you know what to look for when you sit down and read it. Now, this morning, we're going to open that owner's manual, and we're going to look at a story that is both amazing and disturbing. It's found in Genesis chapter 22, beginning with verse 1. It's the story of Abraham almost sacrificing Isaac on Mount Moriah. It's an important story. It's one of the central stories of the Bible. It's one of the best-known stories. If you look at classical and neoclassical artwork, I don't know if you can see that. We need to get this darker up here. Whoops. Paintings of this event are absolutely everywhere. Whoops. That's the Caravaggio version of Abraham sacrificing Isaac. This is the Titian's work, done a little earlier. This is the famous, much-copied Rembrandt. There's about 8 copies of this in the art world. This is my favorite. I don't know if you can see it. It's the Jan Levens depiction. I just love it. There's so much emotion in it. But this is one of the best-known stories in the whole Bible. Let me read you how this story begins. Here's what it says. It says, sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, here I am, he replied. Now, if you have a King James Version, you'll notice that it says, it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham. That's actually a bad translation. My apologies to KJV fans, but I think they missed it on this one. KJV is an incredibly artistic translation. It's remarkably poetic, but it makes as many translation errors as any other version. James 1:13 reads, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. So tempted is not the right word to translate this into. So realizing that, I think a lot of translators have gone with the word tested. God tested Abraham. The Hebrew word is nasah. In only 11 places in the Old Testament is nasah translated as either tempt or test. In 563 other places, nasah, or a derivative of nasah, is translated as lifted up. Isn't that interesting? I think that might be something we should pay attention to. There's a very real sense in which God was to do something, about to do something in this story to lift up Abraham or to elevate him, elevate his faith. Anyhow, here's how God responded to Abraham. Abraham answered, "Here I am." Then God said these words. He said, take your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah, sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you. Now, Jewish tradition identifies the place where Abraham took his son as Mount Moriah. According to the Hebrew Bible, the temple in Jerusalem was built on Mount Moriah. It was originally a threshing floor owned by Arona, a Jebusite. That's a resident of Jerusalem before it was called Jerusalem. King David bought that threshing floor off Arona for 50 shekels of silver, and his son Solomon built the temple there. But today, the Muslim shrine Qubbat al-Sakah, it's called, is located on the site. It's, in English, it's known as the Dome of the Rock. It's built in 1691 AD. It's called that, the Dome of the Rock, because underneath this dome is this rock. Okay? The Muslims believe it's the place where Muhammad ascended into heaven. The Jews believe it's the place where the Holy of Holies in the ancient temple was located. But Jewish oral tradition holds that this is the rock where Abraham took Isaac. This is where it happened. But the really shocking thing in this verse is the fact that God asked Abraham to sacrifice his only son. Now, we need to realize when we read this that there wasn't really a Jewish religion at the time of Abraham. The law of Moses came into being 645 years later. You know, there was Adam and Eve, and there was Noah, and that was about it. Tower of Babel and Abraham. As far as Judaism being a national religion, Abraham was the first. There was no preceding body of religious principles that he could look to. Abraham didn't really know if human sacrifice was part of his relationship with God or not. He was the prototype believer. He was just putting one foot in front of the other, trying to figure this out. But the incredibly confusing thing in all of this was the promise he had received. God had repeatedly told Abraham that specifically, his offspring would go into a great nation, and specifically, it was going to happen through his son Abraham. Then God asked him to sacrifice Isaac on a rock, or through his son Isaac, I should say. And then God asked Abraham to sacrifice Isaac on a rock. I thought about this. I spent a week thinking about this, and I thought, you know what? It's impossible to identify with Abraham in this story. Can't do it. The way this tale unfolds is almost too surreal to connect to. Imagine this. Imagine you were a musician, and God came to you one day and said, "I'm going to make you a star. No time, you're going to be at the top of the charts. I'm going to do this by sending you on a cross-country tour. And to make sure that happens, I'm giving you a brand new 2018 Audi sedan. It's a beautiful car. It's going to take you straight to stardom. There's just one thing I want you to do. Go out and light the car on fire. Destroy it." It just doesn't make any sense. How is God going to take me on tour with this car if I light it on fire? You know, there's an obvious contradiction. You'd be thinking, either I just imagined that God promised to make me a star, or I really didn't hear from him that he was going to use this car to take me on tour. And with Abraham, the whole thing was 100 times more confusing and 1,000,000 times more emotional. This was his son. I got to be honest with you. Abraham's response to God absolutely floors me. If I was in his place, I don't think I would have obeyed. I'd like to think I would have obeyed, but I probably wouldn't have. It's not that I have a habit of disobeying God. It's just that with that much of a glaring contradiction, I wouldn't be sure if I'd actually heard from God. I think that's one of the reasons why God just pounded this thing about Isaac into his head. It kept coming to him again and again and again and again. And then finally he says, okay, now sacrifice him. He was sure that he'd heard from God. I'm not sure if I would have heard from God, if I would have believed myself that I'd heard from God. And even if I did, I'm actually pretty sure I wouldn't be willing to slay my own son. What amazes me about this story is that Abraham encountered all those tensions and turmoils 4,000 years ago. So you know what? I think he did what all the great biblical icons of faith did in their lives. He prayed. And he travailed, and he questioned his heart, and he spent sleepless nights on his face crying out before the Lord. See, these are the things that aren't recorded in the Bible. You got to read between the lines on them. But it's logical to assume that that's the path that Abraham took. He didn't just, you know, say, okay, Lord, I'll sacrifice my son. Yeah, duh. This was a crisis of unbelievable magnitude for Abraham. But in the end, Abraham examined his heart, and he stepped out in faith. You know, that act of examining your heart is such a critical part of walking in a relationship with God, of building a friendship with God. It's a lost art in today's world. It really is. People think with their feelings in today's world. They listen with their eyes, and they think with their feelings. Rabbi Zacharias coined that phrase. But I watched that cultural shift occur when I was still doing advertising and marketing down in southern BC. I almost didn't notice a change, but one day I realized that the truth didn't matter anymore. All that mattered was the image I was presenting to the consumer and how the consumer felt about that image. If I could elicit the right feeling, we could sell the product. You know, when we authentically examine our hearts before the Lord, we actually don't do it with our feelings. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say that. It's not that feelings aren't involved. They're just not the driving motivator. Examining your heart before the Lord is ultimately an exercise in reason. You see, God judges by the heart. Abraham's heart was telling him to do what God was asking. But you know what? It wasn't an act of blind obedience. A lot of people think this story is about obeying God. It's not. It's a story about trusting God. That's a different thing. God will ask us to trust him in a lot more situations than he'll ask us to obey him. You know, that obedience card had already been played in Abraham's life. God told Abraham to leave Ur and travel to Canaan, so he did. God told him to circumcise all the males in his household, he did. Even last week, you know, God told Abraham to send his son Ishmael out into the wilderness, he did it. The story of God asking Abraham to sacrifice Isaac isn't about obedience, it's about trust. Even though his feelings were screaming at him that sacrificing his son was a terrible thing to do, Abraham was willing to trust God that somehow everything was going to work out okay. Now here's the deal in this. Here's the thing we need to get out of this story. When it comes to being shaped into a friend of God, trust is the ball game. It's everything. I'm not one of those people who needs a lot of friends, but the common denominator in people that I call my friends is trust. We trust one another. Friends trust friends. Let's read on. Verse 3, early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. Again, almost every commentary I read on this passage said that God was testing Abraham's faith by asking him to sacrifice Isaac. You know what? I think there's a disconnect with that idea. God is omniscient. He's infinite in his knowledge. God didn't have to test Abraham's faith. He already knew how Abraham was going to respond. That's why I think we're probably missing something in translating that word nahash as tested. Lifted up is probably more accurate. God was lifting up Abraham. He was enlarging his faith. This whole exercise wasn't for God's benefit. It wasn't for God to find something out about Abraham. This exercise was for the benefit of Abraham. And if God was doing this in the process of developing his friendship with Abraham, think about the implications of that for us. What will God do to enlarge our faith? What will he ask us to do? You know, it's not that God would have washed his hands with Abraham if he hadn't trusted him. He still could have gone on to have a good relationship with God. It just wouldn't have been the best relationship. You know, God is an infinite God. He always goes for the best. He always goes nth degree. Let's read on. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servant, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you." You know, I think Abraham wasn't sure how God was going to do this, but there's a little suggestion in here. Did you notice it? That he either didn't or he wouldn't believe that God was going to let him take Isaac's life. Abraham told his servant, "Stay here, we'll worship, and then we'll come back to you." Verse 6, Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering, placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. You know, I just love to read between the lines in the scripture. This verse tells us something of the truly ancient nature of this story. Abraham was carrying the fire with him in a fire pot. That's a Neolithic practice. You know, in order to make a fire on the spot without anything else, you either have to rub two sticks together, which I learned how to do. It takes about an hour. Or you need a flint and a steel. And there was no steel in the days of Abraham. The story is pre-Iron Age. This is a very old story. There's some archaeological evidence that people would sometimes strike flint against iron pyrite rocks, but I looked this up. You can't find pyrite and flint in the same place in Israel. You got to go to the far corners to do it. But in Abraham's day, once you had a fire going, you kept it going. You used these fire pots. Anyhow, the two of them went on together. And Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father." "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And the two of them went on together. You know, one question that's been asked by biblical scholars for centuries is, how old was Isaac when this happened? You may have noticed from some of those paintings, like I said, that our lighting's not great here, but there's a wide variety of ages depicted for Isaac. He was old enough to know how a proper sacrifice was supposed to occur. And he was old enough to carry enough wood for a burnt offering. That's actually a lot of wood. Somehow I don't think Isaac was a toddler. And that sort of brings another element into the story. Abraham was almost 100 years old, yet Isaac allowed him to bind him and lay him on the altar. I think he could have resisted. Isaac could have overpowered Abraham. So I don't think Abraham was the only person demonstrating immense faith in this story. Verse 9, when they reached the place God had told them about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood, and then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven. Oops, do I have this? Sorry. You push the button and sometimes it... Angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Here I am, he replied. Do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. Abraham looked up, and there in a thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." Then Abraham returned to his servants, and they set off together for Beersheba. And Abraham stayed in Beersheba. Well, like I said, this is one of the great stories of the Bible. It's got passion, it's got drama, it even has a surprise ending. But there's one question, you know, we haven't answered yet, and that question is, why? Why would a loving God do such a thing? Couldn't God have enlarged Abraham's faith in a less disturbing manner? I'm sure this took years off of Abraham's life, even though he was 100. You know, in order to really get the story of Abraham and Isaac, I think you have to read the first chapter of Matthew in the New Testament. Abraham was ground zero for the lineage of Jesus Christ, the human lineage. This line had to be incredibly strong all the way from beginning to end. The line of Abraham needed to have great spiritual DNA. God didn't want Abraham to merely believe the promise. He wanted him to own it. He wanted it to be part of his being. Just imagine years later, Abraham sitting by the fireside with his grandson on his knee, Isaac's son, Jacob. And in a moment of quiet, Abraham turns to the boy and says, "Let me tell you a story about God. Someday our family will become a great nation, and here's how I know that to be true." See, faith isn't formed in the sunshine. Faith is formed in the furnace. Israel is historically one of the smallest nations on earth. It's been conquered numerous times. It's been enslaved by more powerful nations. Most of its citizens have been carried off at one time or another into captivity. The Greeks, the Romans, the Persians, the Muslims, the Crusaders, the Ottomans, the British have all conquered and occupied Israeli territories. In modern times, the Nazis tried to wipe the Jews from the face of the earth. From 136 AD to 1948, Israel didn't even have a country to call their own. Yet if you go on Google Maps and type in Israel, there they are. 4,000 years after Abraham was laid in the grave. Let me close with an equation. This is spiritual mathematics of the story of Abraham. The promises of God, plus the trust of those he's created to be his friends, it's unstoppable. It was true in the days of Abraham and Isaac. It's true, every bit is true today. And you know, trust, it's like a piece of coal. It only turns into a diamond under pressure, great pressure.